State Auditor's Office. The main purpose of the bill is to create a definition of political subdivision that will be used consistently throughout the chapter to talk about political subdivisions. Right now, there are some references to local units of government and some places where there are lists of local units of government, but this will make it consistent and create a definition for political subdivision. And it will make our oversight consistent in the law over all of the local units of government, including special districts that are created from time to time. It's a lot, in this sense, I think it's a lot like what you did in 2005 with Chapter 13, where you took that list of state agencies, political subdivisions, and statewide systems and created a new definition for government entities that was easier to deal with in Chapter 13. And it arose because of some studies we did on special districts in Minnesota. In 2004, we found that special districts had $746 million, which is three times more than the total revenue of all the towns in Minnesota, and there are close to 1,800 towns in Minnesota. And we found that a lot of times these special districts weren't preparing financial statements or weren't preparing them in a timely manner, so we made suggestions that they prepare financial statements and submit them to our office, and I'll get to that when I go through the section. I'd like to walk quickly through the bill without taking too much time to kind of point out a few things. The first thing is Section 1, that's the definition that I talked about. It has a definition of special district that feeds into the political subdivision definition to create that continuity throughout the chapter that I talked about. Then in Section 2, we crossed out some archaic language that made us come up with a check form for all local units of government. The banks create good enough checks, so we don't need to do that anymore, so we crossed that out. And throughout the rest, you can see where we crossed out lists of local units of government or different types of references and replaced it with political subdivision. Until we get to Section 19, which requires special districts to report to us when they're created so that we know about them so that we can include them in our statewide report. And then it also requires that they have audit requirements that are exactly the same as those for towns with combined clerk treasurers. So it has a total annual revenue threshold, which started in 2004 at $150,000, and that is adjusted each year by the implicit price deflator, just like it is for towns and cities. We feed into that, which is a reference to 412.591 there. If they're under that limit, they need to have an audit once every 5 years, just like towns and cities with combined clerk treasurers. If they're over that, then they need to have an annual audit, basically. We also have a provision here that they need to provide the audit to us within 180 days, and that just allows us to have more contemporary information. It's exactly the same as the requirements for cities in 471-697. And the final thing is Section 21, we've got some improvements to the watershed annual audit section. It currently has some archaic language in it. It currently provides that they do have to have an audit every year, but it says it must be made by a certified public accountant or the state auditor's office at least once every 5 years. That's archaic language because this was written at a time when they had certified public accountants and also licensed public accountants, and that's the distinction they were making there. There's no longer any distinction in the accounting world. There's no longer any license for licensed public accountants. They all became certified public accountants a couple of years ago. So that's just crossing out some archaic language. And then we finally put in a sentence there that makes our oversight over watershed districts consistent with all of our other oversight. It just says we can conduct such examinations as we deem the public interest to demand. And that means that if somebody has a problem, somebody thinks there's a theft at a watershed district, we can go in and look at that theft. We don't have to do a whole audit of the whole entity. So it increases the efficiency with which we can work. Thank you.
Mr. Carroll, I can't quite figure out how the Metropolitan Council is considered in this. When I read the first part, it looks like they're excluded.
Well,
political.
What's excluded there is those entities that are audited by the legislative auditor. So under Chapter 3, Section 3.971, the legislative auditor audits the Metro Sports Facilities Commission, the Metro Airports Commission, and the Metro Mosquito Control District. So this is a reference to those three entities.
Okay. Right. And so, yeah. Okay. Are there any further of this bill? As I said, it was pure controversy, just the Senate's idea of what the forms of bills could be. Okay. I guess, and this then just goes to the floor. We have to send it to finance, and they send it to the floor.
Okay.
Okay. So I'd move that Senate File 1436 be recommended to pass and be referred to finance. Okay. Questions? Okay. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we now have OEP report on electronic document study and the IT funding strategy. And I guess John Lawley is the person going to be giving these.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for inviting us. My name is John Lally. I'm Planning Director for the Office of Enterprise Technology. And I was the responsible party for the two studies that we're going to be discussing. Put together with fairly broad involvement. Last session, if you will recall, we were asked to provide you with information on two particular aspects of the future direction for the state. One about possible alternatives for funding for information technology. The other one had to do with the possible adoption of technical standards around electronic data collection, preservation, recovery, use, everything. And I'm going to give you a brief overview of the results of our analysis. What I would ask you, because I'm skimming across the top of this, if you have questions, please ask them as we go through with the presentation, and I'll be happy to try to address them.
Okay.
The first one I'm going to talk about is the IT funding alternative study. And the bad news is I don't have a $935 million savings that I can offer up to you for this biennium. If you were waiting with bated breath for that good news, I'm sorry, I can't do that. And I'm also not going to be suggesting to you alternatives like investing in the Irish sweepstakes as a potential way of us getting money for information systems. We're trying to take a much more prudent and process-oriented view of funding for technology, as I hope you will agree. The reason why we're trying to do this is recognizing that the traditional methods of funding have not always been particularly appropriate for technology projects, nor do they always lend the results that you would like to have in terms of accountability and performance out of the systems that they create. We have a major, major problem facing technology. Much of it is outdated. Putting aside the security issues that you've heard from our Chief Information Security Officer, Chris Boozy, in the past, we have a lot of legacy systems that are trying to be replaced. At the same time, we have a lot of citizen demands and business demands to do more of our business online, free from the constraints of 8 to 4:30 brick-and-mortar service delivery that we've had in the past. But those three factors, the risk of failure, the cost associated with operating the current system, the security issues, and the new paradigms for service, all argue that we have to come to you with a better way of funding IT. The current funding approach is following the biennial budget process. God love it, but it does not comport with long-range planning. What we end up doing is making accommodations that aren't necessarily in the best interest of the systems or the customers of those systems. And it's also not quite as flexible and responsive to changing circumstances and events as we believe it has to be. I'm going to describe to you what, from our perspective, is the ideal funding process. Not everybody would agree on it, but we think it's appropriate. It has to be flexible. We need to be able to match an array of funding tools to the particular situation that we're confronting. Not one solution will fit all circumstances, and many situations will demand a combination of alternatives as the best way to fund the total cost of ownership for a system. We need a system of proposing and approving funding that is thoughtful, by which I mean has to be consistent with the long-term business needs of state government business, being the services that our individual agencies render as part of their mission. And to do it before we're in crisis, we need to anticipate problems rather than react to them. We need to look for ways that we can consolidate our responses to opportunities rather than simply continue the historical method of developing every system in silos, which is both more costly and much less able to provide the quality of service you would expect. We want to have our system funding support our strategic view. Now, that doesn't mean there won't be situations where we have to respond to an immediate need, but we'd like to adopt an investment mentality that rather than spending, we are investing money in IT with an eye to the long haul, that it will be consistent in architecture and presentation, reducing the support cost and the need for modification. We want, as much as you do, accountability in the system, that when we estimate what the cost is going to be, we can deliver a system for that cost. When we tell you what the system needs to be able to do from a performance and functional level, that it delivers those functional features at a performance level that we say they will, and that we'll be managing it thoroughly throughout its life cycle. And finally, we want to exercise the advantages of enterprise purchasing and enterprise development to save money in the development process rather than reinvesting in duplicative elements of our infrastructure and our systems. The things we think the financing solutions that we choose must have to give us that ideal system or something closer to it, the funding has to be reliable and realistic. The situation where we create funding estimates for a system and then ignore them, that in our planning processes we don't take into account the support costs for the system over time, is very destructive to the health of the system and to the ability to implement a system that's needed. There ought to be some rewards in the system for prudent management. We should be able to begin planning for the retirement of a system before it fails by anticipating through performance management when the system needs replacement and begin to invest in the planning for that replacement before it becomes a crisis. We need to have effective planning and oversight. My background is in the Department of Revenue, where we consider an audit not to be a punishment tool, but a quality assurance tool. We think we need the same sort of oversight as project management to see that projects stay on cycle, not that they're caught after they've made a mistake. And that oversight function is really critical. Stakeholders, including you, have to have confidence that when we come to you with information, the information is sound and reliable, and the story isn't going to change when we walk out the door. We have to do a better job of reporting on the cost and the benefits, both financial and non-financial, of developing and operating systems. That information should be presented both to our management and to our overseers in the legislature in a way that is clear enough and understandable enough to help you assess whether or not we've been successful. We actually do listen to legislators. That may sometimes be hard to believe, but we do talk to legislators and try to understand what they want from us. And what we've heard talking to you in groups, talking to you individually, is you ought to feel comfortable when you are allocating the public money that the estimates are accurate, that the information you're getting is correct and current and not distorted by enthusiasm or desire to get what we need. You want to know that all of the financial processes that we have and the design processes, acquisition and project management, have integrity, so that the acquisition process is an open process and we're getting the best value for the taxpayers out of every dollar that you entrust us with. You want assurances that as we go through these processes, that the best practices is a term of art in our area, that good project design and management practices are in place and working. We have the authority in OEP under the law
to go in and kill a project if it goes bad. We don't ever want to have to exercise that authority. We'd much rather work with the agencies and the other organizations to try to make sure that the project never goes bad, that if there are problems in mid-course, they are corrected before they become critical or expensive to fix, and that the systems that result are sound and well-managed. You want to make sure that we don't waste the public money any more than you want to waste the public money, that we have a strong commitment to delivering good value, not to buying a Rolls Royce when a Chevrolet would do. And you want to be confident, as do we, that the public interest is well served. So this is kind of the background to how we went into this study, looking at it. Our study group was made up of people from my agency, the Office of Enterprise Technology, from the Department of Finance, and key legislative staff who helped us in the early parts of this. I say that in the early parts of this because I didn't want to co-opt them into necessarily supporting all of our conclusions. So at a certain point, it becomes our product and not their product.
Well, let me... it must be in between the lines of that last slide, but I just would almost like it more explicitly because I think it's something that went wrong with a product before you got there. How do we say that there isn't political influence on things like the speed and the timing on when something comes out and the decision about whether we're going to repair something or set it down and start all over again and so forth?
Without looking at what happened in the past, which obviously neither of us can influence, we've tried to put the emphasis in our description of best practices into things like doing a business case. There's a case for action for doing something that looks at the strengths and weaknesses and all the positives and negatives. And that when that's done, there's a business plan and a project plan that will look at what is the best way to get there. So there should be, from the solution, to use my old revenue terms, an audit trail back to when the discussions took place that will examine what were the basis for making the recommendations we did and can we substantiate them. I can't promise you that all of those are absolutely pristine because they're human processes, but we are trying to do the best we can to make sure that there is a factual and a logical basis for the recommendations that we make. Our involvement with the agencies, I might add, is different depending on the agency, and it tends to be that we are less involved with the agencies that have a track record of doing a good job of project management and following through on issues. We are much more interested in being involved in detail where there's been a history of failed projects or of problem areas. There are unfortunately not enough of us to do this work for all the agency projects that are out there, so we do rely on a very strong and positive working relationship with the agency professional project managers, with our governance process that involves agency CIOs and line managers. But we are trying to exercise reasonable oversight over all of the enterprise IT expenditures and projects, at least as much as our resources will allow.
So, I guess I'm kind of looking for the assurances. You're looking at rolling out something on a particular date, and someone above you says we need to roll it out earlier because we want to have a press conference on it, that would never happen?
Madam Chair, you're asking me to give an assurance that people higher up in the hierarchy are never going to make decisions like that. I cannot make those assurances.
No, I'm only asking as to whether you'll follow them or whether you will.
Madam Chair, the question
is if someone says, well, for example, we should put out the driver's license system on electronically before it's ready to go. You will say, okay, if that's what you want, we'll do it.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to say this accurately and honestly. I can't imagine that we would approve a system that we were in doubt about its readiness to go. That doesn't mean bad decisions can't be made, and that doesn't mean there isn't political influence on our environment. I have to say, in the 3 years I've been with the Office of Enterprise Technology, that has not happened.
They're BS. I'm just kidding.
It's not a sophomore platinum.
I thought there were enough qualifications in that so that he was pretty safe that it was accurate.
Heard like a dagger tongue.
Okay.
When we went through all of the options and we looked at what was done in other states and we looked at previous research that had been done, because what we didn't want to do was just recast everything that had been done in other studies. Many of you know Jerry Meckling from Harvard, the Kennedy School. Jerry did a good study on IT funding about 6 years ago or 7 years ago. NASIL, the National Association of State Chief Information Officers, did a study in 2003 looking at IT funding mechanisms. We didn't simply want to summarize and report on that. What we were trying to do was to cast what we know about IT funding options, both in the public and private sector, into our Minnesota environment, so that what we're talking about is what can or should work here. Some of it is controversial, but we didn't duck it because of the controversy, as I hope you will see as we get further on. So I'm going to very quickly cover the options and then talk a little bit about how we see them being appropriate. The most obvious option is legislative appropriation. The mainstay, most of the major systems efforts in Minnesota are done through legislative appropriation. It works. The problems with it are largely related to the fact of the follow-through. This is making an assumption that the funding is adequate to begin with. But life cycle funding is typically not, it cannot be provided for in direct appropriation, so it requires follow-on in subsequent years. So I'll talk about total cost of ownership and life cycle funding in just a moment. Second base for much of what we do is on the basis of user fees and charges. And this, for example, is what constitutes 90% of the OEP budget. This is like in the private sector. I need a service that may be internet access, internet telephony, disk storage, printing, network capacity, desktop support. I pay you to deliver a certain level of service. We have an agreement on that. There are rates set with the agencies and with the oversight of the Department of Finance. That rate goes into effect for a year, and you pay us for the volume of traffic that we provide or the capacity that we provide. Very significant, very straightforward. It is anything but straightforward in coming up with a rate system. It takes about 7 months of concerted effort to come up with the rates every year because there are thousands of discrete rates that we have to come up with. The third part is internal funding, and this is typically done within an agency as they capture savings or capture funds that are available through salary savings or whatever it might be, and use that money most often to fund routine updates of systems that aren't provided in any other way, or to do planning for the future implementation or replacement of a system. And it's simply reallocation of internal resources. Those are by far the three most common ways of funding individual systems in the state today. Fourth alternative that we're beginning to see emerge, and I think you've heard my boss, Paul Kahn, talk about a number of occasions, is the use of an enterprise investment fund where you can capture savings from process efficiencies or from the kind of money that otherwise would be spent on the internal funding that can be used on enterprise projects, shared service projects that go across multiple agencies. This is an investment fund. It would have strong oversight and control. And if our recommendations were to be followed, it would be left alone by both the executive branch and the legislature, so it wouldn't be considered a target of opportunity when we have a $935 million deficit. Another method is vendor participation, which is really a number of different approaches. Vendor participation can be something as simple as complicated as benefit funding, where a vendor will come in and say, hey, I'll pay for your new system, and I get to get sort of the savings derived from using that new process. It is anything but simple to implement. It has been used successfully. It has been used unsuccessfully in a number of states, but it is an option. Others involve using vendor financing, which can be more costly than funding it internally through the budget process. What it does, if you don't have money and you need a system in a hurry, using the vendor capital approach, even with the cost of capital and the carrying charges and the profits, might be an alternative to be considered. Others situations can be joint development of a product that is then marketed. I've been involved in two of those episodes in the last 20 years. One was very successful, one was interesting, because it's often hard to measure the benefits from that sort of a situation and apply it to what we're doing. But it's an option. It's the kind of thing that for a situation that comes up might be an appropriate solution for it.
You know, so one of the I don't know if you watch what other, what say, local units of government are doing in these things, but one of the it seems to me it's the scandal that the Minneapolis City Council seems has the ability to just say, oh well, we just did that and let's move on, which was the funding of a system with the convention center to do a whole, to come up with some special system to do something that did things better that convention centers do, that they were doing it with a vendor, and supposedly the issue was they were going to make tons of money out of this, that they were going to sell it to other convention centers or tourism centers all over the country. And the I don't know if they've quite pulled the plug on it yet, but they've put just piles of money out. The city never quite puts as many piles of money as the state does, but it was big numbers. And talking to someone that I know who's kind of knowledgeable about these things said that it was a totally flawed idea, that you really have to get for one entity, which had really specific things that they wanted, to try and think that they could ever market something that would be universally marketed. And this company kind of took them for suckers to begin with. Does the state ever get into anything like that, where they're trying, where this might make sense, that you had, you know, a bunch of entities who had known similar needs cooperating together, so that you knew that you had customers. When you finished doing it, all your customers were already at the table, instead of saying, we're going to do something and get it out to customers. And I don't know, you know, I hope I didn't garble what happened too much, but did you pay any attention to that issue? Or?
We do follow some of the trends, although typically we don't know the specifics of what's going on. And there's two different...
Did you follow that one in Minneapolis? That was
just what was in the script, basically.
Okay.
There's two different takes on that. One is that the development with other jurisdictions of common software, Minnesota has done that. They've developed programs with other states that have common needs, and we share the development costs and then share the use of the project afterwards. And that does work. It requires a commitment up front to tailor your business practices to the software rather than customize the software to meet your particular preferences of doing business. In those kind of situations, it can be very successful and save a lot of money. The other situation, which I was referring to earlier, in one case we worked with a software development company that was coming up with an application that was, as I recall, it's been a long time now, as I recall, it had to do with mineral valuation or transportation, aircraft valuation, I'm sorry, airflight. And we worked with them. They tested the software in our environment, and it worked. We got it for free, saving us $100,000 or so, and then they, in turn, marketed it to other states, hopefully successfully, but that wasn't really our problem. I've also been in situations where we worked with developers to customize modules from public sector, from private sector to public sector use, because there are different things, different ways we handle things. And in return for our cooperation in developing it, we got the software at a deeply discounted basis, and they were then theoretically turning around to market it. That wasn't as successful, simply because the cost of the modifications that Minnesota state law required, by and large, didn't help them in other states. Our situation was uniquely Minnesotan in a lot of respects. It can work, but it takes a great deal of discipline and a lot of attention in the design stage to make sure that what you're talking about delivering and what you're actually getting are the same thing. But you can say that about any project.
Is it, and maybe Mr. Connor is the appropriate person to ask this, or whoever does it, but is there any work on the national scene or even the international scene to look at problems that everybody's going to have, and the thought that maybe we can do some kind of a base solution and then step out to get, and then go from there to get modifications?
Madam Chair, I can address it, but Paul is here if you'd like him to address it too. But
no,
we participate in a number of organizations at the national level, like NAFIL, where we talk about problems in common and explore opportunities to solve them in common. What is more likely a source of those kind of agreements would be disciplinary agencies, the Association of Tax Administrators, the Public Health Association, where district and agency administrators get together and talk about those things. I'm not familiar with how many of those disciplinary solutions are in place, or even what the trends are in terms of the numbers of them. I don't know if Paul has a better answer.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Gopal Khanna, State CIO, Office of Enterprise Technology. Madam Chair, your observation is right. Yes, at the national level, the National Association of State CIOs is always deliberating and talking about possibilities where we could have cross-jurisdictional opportunities to collaborate and have single software. We would love that kind of an opportunity. However, the real challenge is that every state is in a totally different stage of deployment and the way they manage their businesses as well as their local laws, etc. So we have not been able to come up with literally any one area where we could use the same software, even ERP solution, which is sort of say our MAPS replacement or equivalent of MAPS. ERP, yet the customization is what really changes the whole nature of the deployment of the software, so there's very little room for achieving that. It would be the right thing to do, but for some reason we have not been able to accomplish that.
Okay, thank you.
The next method that is used successfully in some states and isn't an object of some discussion here is bonding. In many of the discussions that talk about bonding for software here have come up against a potential constitutional barrier against bonding for software, and that is because of the definition of bondable to exclude intellectual property. They want stuff that hardware, buildings. So we have the situation often described where you can bond for a $5 million building but not for a $50 million system that runs in that building. We did a lot of exploration with that. Bond Council are notoriously conservative. We've had discussions with people here, including Representative Winkler, who's not here at the moment, but trying to look at are there other ways that that can be interpreted, and the answer, quite frankly, is we don't know if there's a way to get around that. The broader question that emerged from our discussions was, do we want to? Because the question is, will the bond market support that? And do we really want to compete for the state's geo-bonding capacity, full station credit capacity, against buildings and other public goods that people would be inclined to use the bonding process for? But in that discussion, we also discovered that while we haven't had a lot of dialogue around this, the option of revenue bonding still exists. And there is no constitutional problem that we're aware of, or a legislative problem, to dedicating a revenue stream, such as user fees or license fees or something like that, to pay off the bonds used to construct a system. Then the issue is, again, will the bond markets give us a cost-effective way of funding that is better than legislative appropriation or something else? But the revenue bonding option does seem to be available. I will show you in a moment a table of states that will list some of the states that do it. A couple of them, like Massachusetts, make extensive use of GO bonding. Quite a few more states and a lot of local jurisdictions use revenue bonding to support software acquisition and development.
When I asked the CIO in Massachusetts, when I think he first mentioned that they were using general obligation bonding, and I said, well, how does your constitution allow that? And he said, John Adams wrote us a really good constitution. So I don't know what the differences are between the Massachusetts and Minnesota constitutions, and I don't know what the differences are between the Massachusetts and Minnesota bond houses, but, you know, I still maintain that I can't believe that 150 years ago people knew enough when they were writing the constitution to exclude software. Well, what about the hardware? These systems are around with modifications, you know, for more than the 20 years that we've
Conversations with my counterparts in several other states, including New York and California,
And we've come to the conclusion it isn't always what's in the Constitution, it's what isn't in the Constitution that gets the attorneys excited. And the bond counsel market is a very limited and conservative subculture within the legal profession. And so we're leaving it up to you whether or not, in fact, that ought to be addressed through statute or if that'll take care of the Constitution. But we will let you know that the general conclusion that we had from talking to our colleagues is bonding, even if it's available, is not widely used simply because the cost of issuing bonds and the problems with getting bond market people to respond positively to it make it less useful in practice than it is in theory. So we'll just pass that on for what it's worth.
But you have looked at then at what Massachusetts is doing and what their rates are and what their bonds...
We didn't have time to go into the detail of each state's constitutional piece. We just talked to some of the folks in their treasury department about it.
I guess the problem is if you're talking to the ones that aren't using it, they're giving you all the good reasons why they're not using it. If you're talking to someone that is using it, maybe you can get some information about why it works for them.
We tried to get information from the League of Cities and the Association of Minnesota Counties about its use in Minnesota and wasn't able to get any conclusive information about people who are currently using it. We just didn't have time to do a more comprehensive analysis. User fees are another mechanism.
Madam Chair, just a comment. And Massachusetts, I hope, is not going to be our example for borrowing in this area. In transportation, Massachusetts is so far in debt that I think they're using about 40% of their revenues now to pay down debt. So, I mean, I just think their transportation funding stream. So they also have an awfully good transportation system in place.
Is in shambles due to over-reliance on debt. So I worry that we bond easily and we have a hard time deciding to actually pay for stuff. I don't want to see us borrow more money, a bunch more money in a brand new area.
But I might point out, Madam Chair, the risk that were quoted to us by some of the states was programs change dramatically, not computer programs, but the administrative programs and services that they support. And you could find yourself in a situation where you bond to create a major system. 5 years later, the federal law changes, the state law changes. It's no longer appropriate, but you're still paying for it for the duration of the bonding system, which is why the time payment rather than the stage payment process is problematic. You don't want to pay for what you aren't using or run out of money when you have to make major modifications. So just kind of the environmental thing around that. User fees are quite often used, both in Minnesota and other places. Common example of that is reservation systems, licensing systems, where the cost of the license fee or surcharge that you pay supports the creation or the operation of a system that issues the license. This is quite common. It has, we'll talk about in a moment, it has limitations. Another option that we've talked about, and we haven't been able to find anybody that uses it effectively on major systems, but the idea of lease or lease purchase of software. The state does have a very active lease program for hardware, servers, routers, major pieces of hardware, where we have a capital lease program. It has some very serious limitations in how much of that can be software. So you can lease, for example, a package that includes the software component of the operating system or the network system and so on. But when it comes to software by itself, there are current restrictions in how we handle that would have to be addressed. And we didn't go into the specifics of that in detail, but that is an option that is available. It tends to be used primarily when you have generic software, an accounting system that is generic by its nature, or some other product that's not likely to change a lot, and you can buy what they call commercial off-the-shelf software and implement it. Leasing tends to be done more for those sorts of things than for custom systems. Outsourcing, and I want to make clear when I say outsourcing, we looked at terms like insourcing and right sourcing, and it got pretty awful if you're a student of the English language. What we're talking about here is for an agency to outsource to another agency
to the level, another level of government, another jurisdiction, or the private sector, a business function and the operation of the system. That's very viable. It is used extensively in the private sector. It's used successfully in some jurisdictions. It is an option. It's not without problems and without cost, but it is an option for many of those sorts of functions. There is, in the life of any kind of application system, a life cycle it goes through. You've got the first phase, the emergence of that system, where you do all the pre-work and pre-design to try to identify what the need is and what it's going to take, what the user requirements are going to be and the business requirements. There's another where you are leveraging the system that you've created to run your operation, do the business processes that you have to have. There's another element when it's mature, where you're into the maintenance mode of the system, and ultimately you get a decline or retirement when the system becomes obsolescent or actually obsolete, and you have to retire the system or replace it. There's a life cycle cost that looks in general like this profile. High cost at the front to do the pre-design and development and implementation and testing and all that. Then as the system is stable and is operating, you get down to just the basic operating costs in the middle of the life cycle. And then as the system grows old and becomes obsolescent, you have increased costs for maintenance and repair and updating until eventually those costs become extensive. The benefits, on the other hand, of a different curve looking at these systems, there aren't any benefits until the system's up and running. By and large, you don't get savings, you don't get performance out of the system. You're making your investment in the software before you realize any benefits from it. But at some point, you start to realize benefits. They might be financial benefits in terms of operational savings. They might be better information, better customer service, more speedy delivery of whatever the product or service is. But you begin to really leverage the benefits of that investment over the life cycle. And then at the end, as the system declines in its utility, generally the performance drops off until at some point it's costing you more than the value you get out of your system. The ideal funding mechanism is going to try to spread the cost so that you don't have the enormous hit up front and you start to realize the benefits at about the same time that the costs are starting to be covered. This is an ideal. We don't often have a chance to plot it out as accurately as this graph would imply. I wish we could. But the principle that's involved, which is that the cost of the system is amortized over the life cycle of the system, is very common in the private sector. It's less common in the public sector for a multitude of reasons. In the development of the system, and this is information we've taken from a number of different sources, typically, the cost of planning and designing a new system is 5 to 15% of the total cost of ownership for that system. So if you're talking about a $10 million system, you have to anticipate that there'll be $500,000 up to $1.5 million of that cost is going to be in the pre-design and the determining of user functionality and system requirements that you have to have in place for that. This is one of the problems that we come into with the traditional approach of funding systems, because often we have to come to you and ask for money before we know what we're going to do. If you don't have the money to do an adequate job of planning up front, it calls into question the accuracy of the estimates down the road. It's a matter of give and take. We're trying to help agencies improve that process through the application of some of the business case I talked about earlier and some general design pieces that will help us make sure that the estimates we bring forth are more accurate than they otherwise would be. But that is an issue. When you get to detailed design and to development and programming and to creation of the technical information infrastructure that underlies systems, the percentage will vary depending on the technology involved. If you're building on the website or building on a mature environment, it's a little less in some categories. If you're starting from scratch with a new technology, it might be a little more. Testing and integration, which is, I'm sorry to say, too often neglected, is also a big cost for a system, and that's to make sure the thing does what you want it to do and serves the needs that you design it to accomplish. And implementation training and acceptance is a much greater expense than most people anticipate when they design a system. But if you take one thing away from the slide, I hope it will be this. that once you've built a system, it's like making a child. The real costs come down the road. The system requires maintenance and reinvestment and operating costs, as all of us who have had teenagers can attest. They are very expensive to maintain. Same with the computer system. You will spend money.
If you refuse to buy them Hannah Montana tickets when they ask for them, it's not that bad.
Madam Chair, I gained this wisdom with my children. Now I'm starting to apply it to my grandchildren. So. For a typical system that in private entity might buy, where you buy and install an application, the cost of annual maintenance might be limited to operating system upgrades and licensing changes and so on. In our environment, where the use of an operating system, an individual income tax system, a health care benefit system, may take it to 10, 15, 20, or 25 years, and you have changes constantly because of changes in state or federal law or the operating environment, the maintenance costs to administer those systems go up dramatically because you can't leave it alone. I bought an application for my Macintosh at home a couple years ago. It hasn't cost me a dime. I wish I could say that for the systems I administer. But if I wanted to do that kind of administrative update on a regular basis to a system here, it's going to cost me. If I don't do it, it's going to cost a lot more because our operating environments and our needs and everything else change with it. This table is an attempt to, in a very much oversimplified manner, to summarize where we think the most appropriate use of these investment techniques fit into that life cycle. It's not perfect. Everyone knows that there's no one-size-fits-all solution. The idea here is to come up with some guidelines that will help people look at which options they should select and present as part of the business case and the business plan that they bring forward. We know, for example, that using a rate-based structure for developing a system doesn't work because you don't have the money in hand until you start collecting the rates for operating the system. Similarly, bonding is not a particularly effective way of financing a system that's going into retirement because you have to wait too long for the benefits to accrue there. User fees are like rate-based systems. You don't get the revenue when you need it to build the system. But a combination of these for any given situation will give you the kind of investment profile you need to look at, will my revenue stream match my operating expenses over the expected life cycle of the system? And as we noted in the report, while in the private sector, business systems tend to have a lifespan of 7 to 10 years, in the public sector, major systems will often run for 20 years or more. So this becomes a very significant thing that we have to plan for. I've included a table, the three that we use. There is a full table in here, this is an excerpt from it, that summarizes what we found by surveying the other 49 states. I caution you about drawing conclusions from that table other than impressions from that table. Because we found out, this was some of the surprise to you, that if you talk to different people in different agencies, you get different answers. So when we talk to the CIO's office in some states, they will talk to us about what methods they use. You talk to their finance departments, and they'll say, oh, no, we don't do that. You talk to the line agencies, and you get yet a different answer. So this is a pretty good indication that all of those systems are used some places, but none of them are used everywhere, and please take it for the value that it has. Any questions?
Yes, you didn't put Minnesota on.
Got done spending the half hour describing Minnesota. I didn't. Really
I know,
want
but you didn't.
No.
But it would be nice to have the X's in the right places. Is the answer that you're not using bonding? But is the answer that you're kind of using all of them, or what?
We are not, to my knowledge, using any form of bonding for any systems in Minnesota.
But for the other
for
four
most
columns.
Of the others, there are examples, someplace successful or unsuccessful, where they've been used. Again, with the exception of leasing, has usually been reserved for those situations where there's a major hardware component. But we can update the table and be happy to do that.
Any questions?
The other study that we were...
Madam Chair, do you have any recommendations for consolidating, authorizing, etc.?
We've
explored, Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, we've explored a number of options for improvement in the process. We think there are things, we make recommendations with respect in the study. We think the process for approving systems needs to be improved, both within the administration and with the legislature. We think we ought to go to more phased funding, where you may approve the total amount so that we can make commitments, but you don't release it until the deliverables and the reports are there to justify it. We think there needs to be a higher level of fiscal analysis that is performed before a commitment is made to a system, and we're trying to explore some of those now and prototype some of those. But it needs some thought and some work, and then we have to try to see, are there rules within the administration or laws that we need to put together a comprehensive package for improvement, and that's what we would suggest we would do after the session over the summer, because we simply ran out of time trying to look at some of that.
Okay. Do we have a date for that?
Should we schedule a hearing?
Yeah, I'll do it. When do you want us to schedule the hearing on?
The 12th.
12th of what?
Madam Chair and members, the other study that
the 12th of what?
12th of never. after okay. I retire, Madam Chair. The other study that we do was a study of how can we best store, use, retrieve, access, share information in an electronic form. And there are two aspects of this. First, dealing with the massive volume of electronic data in a multitude of different formats. There's no question that electronic storage of data is becoming critical. The problems are significant, the benefits are incredible, but we have to get a handle on information management as that discipline. The second is, how do we do that in a way that encourages both security of the data when it needs to be protected so that its integrity is maintained, and also allows for access to that data, both now and in the future. And this is a much more complicated matter than just technology. When I look back at the last 30 years, from the days when I had LPs to when I moved into 8-track tapes and cassettes and CD-ROMs, and now my iPod downloading information off the Internet, there have been a few format changes that have affected my ability to use my previous investment in music. When I look at my history with personal computers, I know, for example, that my first computer, which was an Apple IIe running WordStar on a CPM card, is still in use someplace. We donated to the school district. But I could not load the diskette that I saved the information on into my current computer, nor could I interpret the WordStar file that I use on my current computer. This is a problem that we were trying to address and that you discussed last session when you were looking at how do you adopt a common standard that does two things. It doesn't hinder technology development and create long-term costs for maintenance and support, and that allows for the interoperability and interchange of information with our customers, our citizens, our business partners. And so we tried to recast the discussion not from the way it started out last year, should we go with Microsoft's OOXML standard or the Open Document ODF standard, both of which have substantial international support and neither of which is perfect for our needs or perfectly able to meet those needs. And how do we deal with the fact that the technology, having acknowledged the existence of the standard, then moves on to create the next new standard? If you saw the hard copy of our report downloaded off the web or saw it in the Legislative Reference Library, you will see that it lists some of the hundreds of active standards, public and proprietary, the documents can be stored in. And it's a little confusing for people trying to understand what they could and could not do with those standards. For example, many of us have pictures on our computers that are set off a digital camera, stored in a JPEG format, proprietary standard. Or we'll convert our documents, if we want to exchange this with somebody, to PDF, which is a proprietary standard that's now in the public domain. So it's hard sometimes to understand exactly what are your legal limitations and your technical limitations with the information explicit storage. So we put together a team that involved
not do this from memory, I guess. The background for this was coming up with the information we had last session and trying to do something with that. We put together a team that involved the head of the Legislative Reference Library, the state archivist, people from OET, and some architects from the information area to try to look at and properly cast this discussion in what do we need to assure access and control access and ensure longevity over time. One of the discussions we had yesterday with the Senate when we were talking about this study was, as was pointed out, we may not be able to access our electronic records, but the Declaration of Independence is still available in paper copy. And that's true. Unfortunately, there are some limitations on...
It's on a hemp copy.
Yes. Thank you. As a historian, I should have remembered that. But the fact is, if you want to share that document with about a million people at a time, you run into some physical limitations of getting them all in front of the document. And as I pointed out, people with military records have to deal with the fact that there was a fire in the St. Louis repository that destroyed paper records that had no digital backup. There's no perfect solution, but we can try to find good solutions so that we can protect the most important information and make it available without bankrupting ourselves in the pursuit of perfection. We simply cannot afford to keep a copy of everything in every format that anybody might want. And as an example of that, I will reach into my own history, wherein as the Revenue Department, for a prolonged period of time, we kept paper documents. We kept the digital images of those paper documents, and we kept the digital data taken off those documents. So we had three different versions of every document that came through the door in case somebody might want one of them. Now we've got a somewhat more rational approach to storing that information, but it was indicative of the fact that we were serving multiple generations of documents, many different populations and many different users that needed them for particular reasons. That's too expensive. You can't maintain that kind of environment for the tens of millions of documents that we have in state government. And that's only looking at word processing documents, spreadsheets, PowerPoint presentations like this one, and some database information. You get into the specialized areas of, like, medical record imaging, geographic imaging, CAD/CAM drawings and things like that. The standards that we're being urged to consider don't encompass all of the purposes of those things. And when you start looking at hybrid documents that bring multiple kinds of images and text and charts into one document, it becomes even more difficult. So that's what we were trying to reconcile. What we did after we pulled our steering committee together was take a look at what exists out there. Like the funding study, we didn't want to reinvent the wheel. A lot of people have spent a lot of time and resources studying this problem. We thought rather than try to relearn everything ourselves, we'd learn from other people. And we've been involved in discussions with folks in many states and reading literature from overseas to try to understand where they are and where they're going with the dissimilar situations they find themselves in and also the similarities that they have. We looked at also at what was happening in private sector organizations who were striving to have the same sort of situation managing their electronic documents. And we weren't getting into the legal issues, although they abound, about what kind of documents we have to store. Do we store emails? Where do we store them? How long do we store them? One of the problems that emerged very quickly in this is that Minnesota has very inconsistent laws regulating the storage and retrieval and protection of data, documents, and information. And even within those three broad categories have different definitions in law for different purposes that need to be reconciled. We did an extensive stakeholder survey that we sent out to everybody that we could think of, and a lot of people that made indications that they were interested in commenting on this, that includes the major stakeholders in the format debate. It included people at local governments, libraries, educational institutions, individual citizens, the media, and collected a broad array of responses to the questions that we were asking. Just to be clear, we were not exploring which of the proposed standards was the best. That is not the issue. It's what would best serve Minnesota to have in terms of policy and planning for information management, and that was the focus of what we were looking at. We got all that response. We spent a considerable amount of time trying to absorb it and came up with a set of conclusions that we published in our study. We I think, appreciate, I say I think because I got to look back, some of the responses were not terribly helpful, but some of them were really good and very helpful. They're all on our website if you have a desire to go. Total about 60 pages of very dense type to look at those responses. They are there. We didn't include them for reasons of economy, if nothing else, into the public study, but the information is available publicly. We looked at the research findings and the stakeholder submissions and came up with a report, and that's the report that we sent on to you that is out there publicly. The conclusions we reached, electronic information, I mean, this sounds one of these blinding flashes of the obvious, but we thought it was good to restate it. Electronic information is a critical asset. It's a tool, it's a product of what we do. As a raw material and a product, is absolutely essential that we be able to use it and manage it like we would any other resource. We believe that moving to standards is a good thing. That's why we put such an emphasis on an enterprise architecture, to try to find commonality to allow for sharing of resources like information with the broadest possible population and with the greatest possible efficiency. We know that can help. On the other hand, if you take the wrong standards, like those of you who chose to buy VHS video recordings versus Beta, if you have a Beta video recorder at home, you're probably having problems coming up with the latest movies in Beta format. Similar problem with Blu-ray and the competing HD DVD standard that just went out of existence. If you pick the wrong standard, you can end up making a major investment that doesn't serve you well over a long time. So part of it is doing it right and doing it with the right timing. We don't want to come up with a solution that runs contrary to our goals of serving the public better and protecting the information that we have that we have in our stewardship. We have to also acknowledge that there are no universal solutions. We will remain indefinitely a multi-standard organization for many different categories to accomplish the legitimate business purposes that we have. We don't see in the future a time when every document of every kind for every application that we use will fit into any standard. It's simply too complex an environment to expect that to happen. We look forward to the day when we do have standards, international standards, agreed upon standards, where there's market competition and availability of alternatives that will capture most of the documents that we have. We don't think that time is quite yet. We think there are things we can do to participate in that process to help it, but it's not the right time. And we want to emphasize to you that standards are only one aspect of effective management of electronic documents. The reconciliation of statutes, the provision of resources, just the simple determination of what are we going to save is something we have to address. Depending on how you read different statutes, you might come to entirely different conclusions about what should be preserved within our electronic record storage. So these are our recommendations.
Can I just ask, was trying to recreate what happened or re-remember what happened last session, and was this report the result of a bill that had originally been introduced urging Minnesota to adopt an open
Madam Chair, there was initially a bill that would direct my colleague here to choose from among two competing standards for office equipment. The bill was written quite broadly and would have essentially required us to apply that standard to all documents. And think about how that would play out. If you're a citizen...
And it wasn't related to the open source issue?
That's a separate issue.
Okay.
This was about the open document approval. It gets a little arcane, and I apologize for that. But the open source standards, which apply primarily to Word spreadsheet presentations, was essentially asking us to pick a market winner and loser. This is what Massachusetts did, and Massachusetts was notably unsuccessful in doing that. Because to say to a citizen, no, you have to buy a new software or update your software to send an electronic message to us, creates all sorts of problems. For us to have to constantly convert the formats back and forth, if they don't have that, and then to pay the cost of updating it ourselves in state government, becomes extremely inefficient and expensive. So we worked with the committee chairs and the authors of the bills to try to make it a broader question of not just selecting from two competing standards that both have strong market support and strong vendor support, to a broader question of the use of standards and the appropriateness of it and what should be the process. And that out of that it required a broader study for us about managing electronic information. And that's the language that went in at the end of the session.
And that was the only language then that...
Yes. I might add that California used almost identical language. Their bill did not make it through the session because of other things, not on the merits of the bill. New York has language almost identical to that which we have, and they're going through a similar study. And as a matter of fact, New York has been following closely what we've done, and their conclusions, to the degree I can generalize on them, having not seen their actual final product, which is due out in April, is very similar to what we've uncovered in our discussion.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lally, it looks to me like bullet points 3 and 4 potentially involve legislative action, or at least that might be where we would interface with your recommendations. Is there somebody to carry the ball to clarify statutes and support comprehensive document management, et cetera? Should we be looking for something more? My memory tells me that the bill we had last year was kind of generated by people with a particular interest, other than perhaps just perfect good government.
Madam Chair,
we don't have those advocates here usually.
Good luck.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, we think there are some preliminary steps that should be taken during the interim to bring together people in the market of information management that understand all the intricacies of it and start to try to reconcile what's in law, what ought to be in our administrative support practices. Our strategic information systems plan that we produced last January has identified information management as one of the critical components for future efficiency and information sharing. So we believe what we ought to do is begin another study, the follow-on study to this, not the same study, and to look at what in practical terms has to happen to make this improve.
Another committee hearing?
Yes, another committee hearing.
Could you give us a really good definition of technologically agnostic? It seems like it's something you wouldn't want to say you were.
Madam Chair, technologically agnostic means you're not committed to a protocol or a vendor or a solution. We are looking for the proper solution, not...
it's not equivalent to technologically ignorant?
I certainly hope not, Madam Chair.
Okay.
This is where when we talk about open source, for example, open source is not the same thing as open standards. Open source is software that is developed by a very eclectic range from individual citizens with an interest in something to commercial products. Not the same as free. It simply means they're open standards available to all for inspection and modification. There is a growing use of open standards, open source software. And our state policy has been, if you're looking for a product, you ought to consider open source just as you would proprietary software and choose what is best for your situation based on the business analysis. The situation could arise where you have open source software running open standard software, open standard information. That does exist in the office suite arena right now. Whether that's the appropriate solution, we're agnostic. We don't care philosophically or any other way what the solution is. We just want the best solution for Minnesota. And that's what we define technologically agnostic to be. We don't come in with predispositions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I saw the topic for today's hearing was a technology update, I thought we would hear how much money that the department had spent of our appropriation and what they had spent it on, and how much was left and what their plans were to do with the rest of it. And now that we've received a budget forecast, I'm sure we're going to start looking under couch cushions and rocks and things for some change. And so I'm just wondering if the committee has plans to look at the appropriation we made to OET and what's spent so far and what might be possible to cut to try to close the budget gap.
I assume that you're making that in form of a request.
Well, I didn't know if you already had plans. I didn't want to request it. Family always hates when I ask them to do something that they're already planning to do.
Oh, we like it better than anything else. I think that that's something we're probably going to have to look at for all the agencies that we're dealing with.
Just a preview, Madam Chair and Representative Horton, just to preview our response, there's absolutely no any way that any dollar can be reduced from our
appropriation.
Absolutely. But we're willing to negotiate on it.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Is that on the 12th? Is that going to happen on the 12th also?
Day after. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We appreciate your attention.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. We have the minutes are before us of what day is it? February 19th, and Representative Ward moves adoption of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes are adopted. We told Mr. Nobles that we weren't going to have time for him, and we'll have him on Tuesday with other things. Okay, thanks. And again, as anything that any suggestions that anyone has, how they can solve the budget problems, any departments that you'd like to look at more carefully, you're welcome to do it. And we do have, could have done it while everyone was here, we do have a new page now, who I'd like to have him introduce himself, Jeff, and a second one. We didn't get rid of the old one. Okay. Jeff? Just want to say who you are and where you're from and what you like about it.
My name is Jeff Park. I'm originally from Buffalo, Minnesota, and I live downtown Minneapolis right now.
Okay, great. Nice to have you. Okay, Representative
Winkler? Madam Chair, one thing that may be useful is we're going to look at agency budgets is just to get an update, a fiscal update on what a reminder of what exactly we did last year and what was increase and where and why and all that.
Okay.
I sort of have this vague memory of being in this room for hours on end, really late at night, and the details are...
But we did good things like that. Hillstrom bill, we didn't put in our bill because the Senate wanted a streamlined bill with no extraneous bills, even when they had passed 64 to nothing. So we're here to reconsider it again this year. Okay, well, try and do that too. Okay, you can do it again.